FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Financial Survival Network is brought to you today by Orin Resources, a junior exploration company with the appetite of a major. It's hot on the trail of the next globally significant discovery, creating enormous potential upside for you, the shareholder. Orin is one of the most aggressive exploration companies pursuing high-grade, scalable gold and copper deposits and has a premier seven-project portfolio, including its two flagships, Committee Bay in the Arctic and Sombrero in Peru. Orin's unparalleled technical team and highly experienced management has a history of success in advancing and monetizing exploration assets. No wonder Orin's been called one of the best in the junior exploration sector. Orin trades on the TSX and the NYSE under AUG. To learn more, go to orinresources.com. That's A-U-R-Y-N resources.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 31919. For those numerologically inclined, please tell me what it means. Email us, kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, one thing I do know how to do is add up numbers. Even if I can't do them so fast in my head anymore, I can do them on my built-in app. Yeah, that's right. We don't have calculators anymore. We have apps on our smartphones. And what I can tell you is that the debt boom in student loan is unsustainable, can't go on. Finally, something that's actually fiscally sane coming out of the Trump administration. I'm talking about their desire to force colleges to pay back defaulted student loans, at least within a certain period of time. Don't know the exact details. Sounds great. It will never happen. The educational industrial complex is way too powerful. The lobbyists are already out there buying tickets to sporting occasions for their local congressmen, buying them expensive dinners at the Capitol Grill in downtown D.C., all these good things they're doing to make sure that the universities don't suffer. Well, hey, Danielle Park is on, and jugglingdynamite.com is the site. And Danielle, always, as always, welcome. So we're looking at debt. How do you discourage debt? And pre-call, we were talking about let's make it taxable. Let's tax debt. And you mentioned just make it non-tax deductible so that you effectively pay for it out of your pocket. You know, is it any different? A debt addiction, is it any different than cigarettes, alcohol, drugs, etc.?
No, but I would say it could be potentially worse for a wide scale, like not on an individual. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting because I was just reading a bunch of medical journals that have recently brought out studies about wealth shocks, financial shocks, and the direct correlation that has with health problems, mental health problems, and shortened mortality. And they have shown that, for example, just the, you know, the market decline in the last quarter of 2018, it took a whack off of people's savings because they're so risk exposed. At the same time, you have softness in real estate, and that plunge in net worth, even where people have significant amounts of money, has a direct correlation to sleeplessness, addiction, suicide, you know, the development of anxiety disorders, all that stuff. So absolutely, the more leverage and debt that a society has, the more stress and fragility and health problems and all of the above that are going to flow through. So I would say on a systemic basis, high leverage is a massive health threat, both to individuals and to the stability of the future and to all sorts of things that are required in society to keep stabilizers in check. So the thing we've done wrong for at least the last 30 years is we decided that debt was the elixir and we wanted to add it, more of it at all times. And that was while rates were falling, right? We had the discipline in the 1980s 80s, as in the 70s and into the 80s, as interest rates rose, people had a natural inclination to want to get out of debt quicker, to try and pay things down faster, to try and minimize how much they took on. And indeed, you had lower valuations in property prices as rates rose because people could afford less house. So this is the natural equalizer, and it's a very healthy balancer, if you will, in the real economy. So what we've done wrong in the last 30 years, as I said, as interest rates were naturally falling, as demographics were aging and boomers were needing less capital to borrow, is that we allowed central banks to then re-stimulate, come in and start trying to goose that that slowdown every time the natural pace of debt was decelerating. They came in and said, "Hey, let's spike this punch some more and get people to take on more debt." And they were remarkably successful, of course, because as rates were falling, people had an incentive to refi and say, "Hey, you know, when I took out this, I still remember this. You know, a mortgage I had in the late '90s at 7%." Went to 6, went to 5, and you kept having the incentive to refinance. And even if you had to pay a penalty, you got out and you could, you know, get the mortgage at a lower rate. So now we had that for so long that people became, of course, as we'd said before, if you'd have taken the opportunity of falling rates to consolidate and pay off debt, you know, keep your payments the same and get rid of it, everyone would be in so much excellent condition right now because they would have had an incentive to be debt free. Unfortunately, the incentive worked, as you know, exactly the opposite way, where people doubled and tripled their debt because they could pay more with less in terms of interest income. So, yeah, it's been extremely dangerous, and it has fraught much difficulty in the overall population today. And it's why we're seeing such angst, frankly, between the generations at the moment, because you've got the elder generations, the boomers, who have benefited from the inflating asset prices. They tended to be the homeowners and the security owners. And you've got the young people coming out with just the offsetting equation. You know, on the income statement, they've got the debt on the balance sheet. They've got the debt that supported the asset gains for the older people, and they're just not able to partake in the same way that their parents did.
Yeah, it's really true. They've got the student loan debt, and then they're making less money. In your article, and it was dealing obviously with Canadian millennials who choose the Canadian equivalent of bankruptcy. And I guess in Canada, you can discharge your student loan debts. In the US, you cannot. But they were making substantially less than Gen X, the preceding generation, and obviously the baby boomers. They're making 4% less, which doesn't sound like much, but it's really a lot of money, especially when you don't have any. And only 3% of them own their own homes. So look, I understand that our whole economy is debt-based and debt-fueled, but if we ever hope to get anything under control, we've got to make the price of debt higher than self-financing, because what debt does is destroy savings. Because what is savings? Savings is the act of deferring compensation, deferring consumption, rather, today for a benefit in the future. And debt is encouraging you to consume today and pay it back in the future. So they're really the mirror image of one another, and it's very destructive.
Also, we had the perverse addition, let's not forget. Not only did borrowing rates go to all-time lows in the last few years, but at the same time, savers were making zero on their money in the bank, zero on cash deposits, and next to nothing on even guaranteed deposits. And of course, you recall in 2013, it was that Bernanke was taken to task for making it so that savers were basically, you know, struggling to make ends meet. And he said, well, you should take your money out of safe deposits and put it into the stock market and try and make more yield.
Right.
That was always the maniacal plan, right, was to force people out of savings and safety and into risk and harm's way so that they could bail out the speculators that had blown up the economy in 2008. So the deal that was made there was horrible on both fronts. It was, you know, allow everyone to get very destructive drugs in the form of credit for very little interest, and at the same time destroy all incentives towards savings. And that's why we have so many holes today in the financial fabric of the world. Everywhere that you look, we have, you know, the highest unfunded liabilities in pensions and households and families, and corporations have the most debt. I mean, we've just done it all exactly backwards. So in the aftermath of that, if we can, you know, take something productive from this very negative chapter, it would be that we should stop allowing tax deduction for debt, stop making it so easy for people to get into homes with nothing down or very little down, stop paying executives in shares of companies so that they have this huge incentive to, you know, do everything they can, borrow money and inflate asset prices for their stock, but rather pay them in debt so that they have every incentive to make sure that the company is solid enough to pay back the principal and make the interest payments. If you could just do those two little things, stop making it tax deductible and start paying people in debt rather than shares, I think you would have a long way. The third thing, of course, is to get the crazy people out of the central banks. You know, they are now talking about the next iteration of this now that the global economy is slowing. And clearly, you know, they haven't fixed the debt problem with tons more debt. Surprise, surprise. Now they're talking about things like, you know, going negative on interest rates in the United States, something that's already been in place in Europe and Japan and
hasn't worked.
Very dead. You know that one of the highest incidents of crime right now, growth in crime in Japan, is among seniors who are getting into all sorts of illegal activities because they're desperate for cash. They've had negative yields in Japan for years now, you know, and these are people who went into this crisis period with higher savings than average, higher savings than we have in North America, but you still can't live on nothing when you're, you know, trying to live on your capital. You're literally eating your seed corn. And not only that, even if you're not getting interest in these places, they're actually paying for the privilege of parking capital in financial institutions because they're being, you know, penalized for having savings. So the incentives are so perverse, Carrie. We should not be surprised that we've got this mess. But a couple of things that I do notice that the people that have that are older, you know, our generation and above, tend to have some sort of, I think, unfortunately, incorrect perceptions of the generations behind them. I hear things like, oh, they're lazy, they're unmotivated, you know, and I think that's just tone deaf when you look at the reality that the boomers were bailed out by central banks in the last decade. They're the ones holding the assets. And the young people have no opportunities as a result of that, or very less opportunities. And they have had this inflation in the things that matter most to the young, which is education costs, because directly related to the same debt bubble. Yeah. They also can't find housing. Even rents have gone insanely expensive. So it's very hard to launch when you can't get a good job and you're leg is got a you know, chain and ball of debt around it. So I think that the balancing or the rubber hits the road in the reality that boomers need income as they retire. And we're the flip side, or the corollary of too high asset prices, is low yields on those assets, right? Mm-hmm. So because prices are so high, rents on properties or dividends on securities are not high enough to pay people the income that they were banking on in their retirement. And so that brings us to a tipping point where people, and it's already started, they're starting to have net withdrawals. They're starting to need more out of pensions than pensions are putting in. They need to start liquidating assets in order to free up cash. Mm-hmm. And that's where they need this younger generation to step in. And right now we've got a huge gap in ability of the young people to take over, to buy those assets, to provide that liquidity, and the prices the old people are wanting to cash out at. And so I'm pretty confident that you know, it's going to have to work itself out, because both groups need each other, but mostly the older people need the younger people at this point, both to fund them in their old age, to pay into their social programs, and to buy up the assets they're trying to liquidate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think it is a big entitlement generation, probably more so than the baby boomers. But, you know, I got a letter from a millennial saying, you know, you baby boomers have really screwed things up. And I couldn't agree with him more. I mean, we're the ones that went hog wild over debt, you know, through our generation, which let's say is 46 to 64. So we started kind of taking over in the 90s, and everything fiscally has gone downhill since then. A completely irresponsible and incorrigible, corrupt generation. And I don't see the answers, though, coming from the AOCs of the world, who basically have no economic understanding and don't really understand where the problem came from. Theirs is just put the government in charge of everything. It's all going to work out fine. Don't worry about it, but
so we know. The only thing I would point out about that is, and I follow the stream, and I realize there's a certain what do you call it, naivete at play there. Absolutely. Young people don't have the experience that older people do. But I will say that old people with all their experience and with all their so-called command of the economic theories are the ones who have orchestrated this total disaster, right? So I think we lack credibility when we try and attack the young people for a lack of knowledge of things like classical economics, when classical economics has clearly been the, you know, siren song for all that's gone wrong here and the way it's been applied. So I think, you know, I think that they are upsetting. I think that the young, more vocal people coming in are upsetting the status quo, threatening the status quo. I get it. But we have to understand that we need to work together in this. And that means giving to get from the old folks. That means we have to literally, you know, stop trying to just inflate assets and have it all our own way and realize that prices have to come down in order for income yields to climb and for affordability to be restored and for to get taxpayers into the system to help fund the stuff that the old folks are counting on. So they definitely have to work together in this.
I could not agree with you more. And what you're saying is true. Well, classical economics, Austrian economics, has never been applied here. And even basic Keynesian economics would be plenty warning that the path we're going down, the path we have been going down, was going to be deadly. So it's just politicism over economic reality. That's what we've had. That's what's gotten us here. It's got nothing to do with right or left, because both parties have stood for exactly the same thing and have done exactly the same things when they've had power. And now we're getting to the end of this grand experiment, Danielle. And no, I just don't know.
Another thing that I comes to my mind all the time when I'm listening to the debates between, you know, different groups, and I think that it's hard for older generation people to comprehend that just because we've done something a certain way in their lifetime, you know, when there was 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 billion people on the earth, doesn't mean that we can continue to do it that way when there's 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 billion people on the earth. And so, you know, there's a reticence to adopt new ideas sometimes because, well, that's just not the way it's done, or that's not the way we've done it. And the point is, yes, that is true, but you are unrealistic to assume the status quo can persist with all of the evolving facts and figures that are before us here. And so that's why I think that, you know, another example is, you know, frankly, this whole discussion with China and the trade talks and, you know, the angst that's going on there about the taking of technology and the stealing of patent information and all that. And I've heard a lot of people almost turn it into a racial comment, you know, that, quote, that's what those people are like, sort of thing. And the reality is that if you read history, if you study anything about the developing economies, you'll know that this is exactly what's always happened between emerging and developed economies. You know, Europe stole off of the UK when the UK was the dominant power and Europe was struggling. You know, Japan was also, you know, one of those countries that was taking information from places like the UK and the US in their emergence in the 70s and 80s. So, it, you know, if you look at it, this has happened like this a million times before, as has this pendulum between generations, as has this story of debt gone from bubble to bust, and then, you know, a slow climb back from a long period of sideways. It's all very very normal. And I think we have to stop as people trying to blame a generation or a nationality of people and say, you know, oh, it's they're doing this and they're not doing that, and realize this is the classic story of the human struggle, and it'll never go away. It'll always be the same. And it's always a case of pushing against status quo, evolving systems, change, breaking it apart and starting over.
Yeah, creative destruction at its finest, Danielle. And of course, it's not anyone's responsibility, but definitely the responsibility lies with the baby boomers for getting us into this situation now. And hey, if we had interest rates that really reflected risk and that really were set in a market rate fashion, a lot of what we went through would have never happened. The boom and bust occurs often because of artificially low interest rates that make projects that wouldn't otherwise be economically viable. I'm talking particularly in real estate, where you can really see the difference between a 3% interest rate and a 5% interest rate. So keeping these rates down, besides harming savers, causes the malinvestment. We got malinvestment galore all over the place. But today's malinvestment is tomorrow's sound investment. Once it goes through the cycle and it gets washed out, the debt gets liquidated, then those assets continue on in life. And
so the question I have right now is, how are we going to get the maniacs out of command in the central banking system? Because these are not, this is an international phenomenon. This is not about any one country. If you think about it, you've got the same thought and dogma being employed, whether it's the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, you know, the EU. Mario Draghi last week said that he actually, his quote was that negative interest rates are working well. I mean, if you talk to anyone that's functioning in the real world, like even pensions or insurance companies, even in the financial sector, who are trying to, you know, make their business models work in an environment where capital is being charged,
destroyed
for the joy of being in existence, you know, where the youth unemployment rate in Europe remains, you know, double digit, where savings deficits are everywhere. Pension promises are defeated. This is a lunatic comment. This is beyond tone deaf. And this is a person who now is talking about, well, we'll just look at buying stocks. And, you know, we have a leading case study for this nonsense, and it's the person of Japan, right? Yeah. Well, Japan has been doing this for 30 years.
Yeah.
And the US, the Japanese stock market remains today 30% below where it was in the peak of 89. As I said, the interest rates are negative there out to 10 years. So 10-year treasuries all the way out, earning less than zero for people. Mm-hmm. And you've got this huge problem with old people not being able to fund anything and young people being not able to launch or get started because there's just, you know, so many imbalances in the society. So it is a very destructive force. And because these people were so instrumental in bringing in and implementing the policies that have done all the harm, it seems that it is impossible for them to see the error of their ways. Hence, we must simply get them out and replace, either to change the system entirely so that central banks are not the prestidigitators they've been allowed to be, which is a certainly one of the approaches one could take to this. But if we're going to have a central banking system, then we need to have entirely new thinking in there. And that's one that decides that low rates and too much debt are the disease, not the cure.
Yeah, well, good luck there. I got the questions, but I don't have the answers to that one, Danielle, other than nothing short of collapse is going to dislodge these people from their positions of power. It's just not going to happen. Anyway, that's it for this week. Make sure you check out Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com, especially read her commentaries. Very insightful and powerful. Check out our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter. We got a webinar coming up today at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Just send me an email and I'll give you the info. I'll send you a link. And hey, send us an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. Danielle, talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.